From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, filling in for April Baer. Today, we'll talk about where Michigan stands with the U.S. Census and which communities are underrepresented.
We're going in the right direction, but it's probably going to take a few more decades for the Latino numbers to be accurately accounted for.
We'll also check in with the Michigan History Center about a convention held by Black Michiganders 180 years ago.
They talked about speaking to their white friends and white people that they came in contact with, that they would challenge them and ask them to stand up for them.
And the Kids These Days podcast explores the awkward smartphone ground between teens and parents.
Every time I would come and leave the house, they'd get a notification. And every time I'd come and leave school, they would get a notification. So, like, their phones were constantly buzzing as I would, like, go anywhere.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today, teens use their phones for all kinds of things. Talking to their friends, using social media, dating. But many parents are using those same phones to track where their kids are and what they're doing in real time.
I wish I could choose to just not have a phone sometimes, because I'm envious of people that had, like, back in like the 1960s and 50s, where they're like, "Mom, I'm going out." And the mom and your mom either was like, "No, I don't believe you." Or they were like, "Okay, be safe."
Later in the program, how teens and parents negotiate privacy and trust in the age of smartphone tracking. But first, the census is still being counted across the nation as organizers struggle with the rest of us to ensure that the job is done. Michigan census returns are higher than the national average, but the city of Detroit is behind the national average, and the city's count is behind where it was 10 years ago with the last census. Here to help us wrap our arms around this monumental collection of data is Kurt Metzger. He's founder and director emeritus of Data Driven Detroit. He's also the mayor of Pleasant Ridge in southeast Michigan. Kurt, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So maybe we should start right at the beginning and just outline, why is the census important?
The most important, and we talk about that a lot, is the whole idea that the census determines political representation. Census is used to determine the number of seats in Congress that go to each state, and then is used for the redistricting of all U.S. congressional seats, state and local legislatures. The city of Detroit uses for their districts. Other cities use wards and others. And so they use the actual counts to redistrict all those areas. But then also the most important is the whole funding mechanism. One number that's often repeated is each person represents $1,800 per year for their community. And that's, you know, kind of cobbled together from a number of federal programs. So programs for food programs, education programs, another number of programs that are both population-based and demographic-based, all come out of census numbers. And it is that one shot, right? Certainly the Census Bureau does estimates and they do a survey, an annual survey. But in terms of dollars distributed and political representation and a number of other things, it is that census count every 10 years that determines those.
We've been losing congressional representation and the number of seats that we have steadily over the past few decades. But I believe it was the last census 10 years ago that Michigan ended up being the only state that lost population and didn't gain any population, not just the share of the population, but the number of people. Where do you sense that things are going for the state with this census? Will we continue to see that backslide in the pure number of people who live here?
Based on estimates, we are nearing that 10 million mark again. We had fallen below 10 million. So we are seeing a slight growth. Yeah, the last decade, Michigan and Rhode Island, I think, might have lost a few people, but Michigan was the big loser. This time we're going to see a gain, but it's a gain so small relative to other states in the country that we will continue to lose representation. In 1970, we had 19 congressional seats. And we have lost every decade since then. And presumably we are expecting that after this census finally gets done, we will be down to 13 seats. We will lose one more, even though we've gained population, but certainly we're not gaining population anywhere near what the South and the Southwest states are doing.
So tallying everybody in the nation is a monumental undertaking, and it does seem that every 10 years we're sort of faced with the same struggle to make sure that everybody is counted. Does this year seem, this decade seem different to you, or would you say that the struggles remain the same?
Well, many of the struggles remain the same, but this whole process is just so different than what we've had. This is going to be my fifth census. I started working for the Census Bureau back in the early 70s. So I was there for the 1980 census was the first one, and have been involved with the census ever since then in various capacities. Certainly this census is very, you know, as it was being prepared long before we knew that COVID-19 was going to change the dynamics of just about everything. The census for the first time was going to be an internet-based, that we were going to have three different ways to respond. You could respond certainly the traditional way, filling out a questionnaire, but you also were going to be able to dial in on the internet or call in. And so there were three different ways to respond, and the census started mailing out questionnaires and mailing out information as to how you could connect back on March 12th. And everything seemed pretty good at that moment. And the whole setup was to follow the various procedures that you would have, the self-response period of time after which the Census Bureau would send out enumerators to follow up on those households that didn't respond. And there were the processes of going to group quarters like dormitories and prisons and others to count the people. And also we had homeless and people in shelters, et cetera. And it was a very nicely set up as we've done in previous, but the whole idea of internet-based was going to add a whole new element. And then with the pandemic, everything started to change. And all those dates were thrown out the window, and we are now so different than what we've been in the past. Certainly in terms of the pandemic's effects.
So it seems like it would be sort of bittersweet in some ways that the system is changing this time around, in that there was likely to be some sticky points just going to a different format, being online, and most people submitting themselves in a digital capacity. But then again, the digital sphere seems perfectly appropriate during a pandemic.
Right. It certainly has added that element that you could respond without having to, that you wouldn't have to be involved with enumerators coming to your house or something like that. And certainly it made it much easier in many respects, but it also quickly pointed out, as we've seen in terms of discussions around online education and everything else, we found out where internet wasn't accessible, those communities. So often the communities that have been hard to count in the past are communities that also don't have broadband, or there isn't wide internet usage, or if there is, it's smartphones and people aren't sitting around waiting to answer a questionnaire on their smartphones. And so we've seen broad differences among communities in terms of the Census Bureau releases every day response rates for all cities, villages, townships, counties, states, and even down to census tract level. And along with their response rate, they will tell you what percentage of the responses have come on the internet. And you'll see tremendously varying numbers. So in Ann Arbor would be very high, Detroit would be quite low, Highland Park would be even lower. And you really see the haves and the have-nots showing up in terms of census response. And it also affects, you know, these are the communities that were going to be difficult anyway because of living arrangements, because of high percentage of persons of color, because of communities with large numbers of immigrants, you know, many undocumented, all the other issues that play out in some of these communities that we expected to be difficult. Internet was not necessarily the answer because we found that the internet was not relatively available throughout the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 2018, the Trump administration also announced that it wanted to add a citizenship question to the census that ultimately did not make it onto the questionnaire. But the maybe the lingering effects of even putting out there that there would be a citizenship question still would remain. Do you think that this is going to have an impact or is having an impact on the count at all?
Oh, I think definitely. I mean, I think they, you know, they got their point across. I think there, you know, there was fear anyway among, and there has been, again, this is not new for the 2020 census. We saw it in 2010. We've seen it before. There's a lack of trust in government across the board that's only gotten worse over the last decade. It was terrible in 2010 because of the foreclosure crisis and all the other issues that were going on. But this Trump administration's targeting of immigrants in all the ways that they've done that has just, you know, bred fear throughout the communities. And then when they threw this idea of adding a question and then lied, bald-faced lies from the Secretary of Commerce about why that question was being requested and then luckily thrown out in the Supreme Court, although not as well as, you know, strongly as it should have been. There's a lingering fear that the Trump administration, no matter what, is going to figure out some way to use the census to get back at immigrants. And I think that a lot there are a lot of people that don't even realize to this day that citizenship question isn't on the census,
mm-hmm.
but they assume even if it isn't, there are other ways that they're going to be targeted. And I think that's obviously suppressing the vote for them. And it's accomplishing exactly what the Trump administration wanted to do.
We'll continue our conversation with data specialist Kurt Metzger after the break. We'll talk about the communities that are actually most vulnerable to being left behind and out of the census count. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, filling in for April Baer. We're continuing now with my conversation with Kurt Metzger, founder and former director of Data Driven Detroit. He's been tracking the census for many years, and he continues to do so this go-round. The state overall is reporting higher than the national average in Michigan, and we're also doing better at this time of the year than we were 10 years ago at the same time. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't been the case in the city of Detroit, and I wonder, first, if we're seeing that anywhere else aside from the city of Detroit, and also what the causes would be that we are seeing this lag in the city compared to the rest of the state.
Yeah, Michigan has been running third in the country in terms of response rates. So as of yesterday, it was 68.3%. And so that ranks at third in the country behind Minnesota and Wisconsin. Good old Midwest. But we have found that, as was expected, we always talk, the census always prepares communities of color. There are undercounts. They are difficult to enumerate. Back in 2010, I complained a great deal about the fact that the city of Detroit was not getting ready for the census. Obviously, there was a lot of change at the top, and there was so much else going on in the city that they were not geared up. They didn't have the resources. They weren't interested in doing the census. It was going to be, I felt, the hardest census that they had had because of foreclosure, because of issues around immigration, because of a number of other issues. And sure enough, the 2010 population came in and it was much lower than was even than most experts had expected. This time around, Mayor Duggan and his staff really basically looked at it as an election. I mean, they really pulled all the stops and they prepared a tremendous outreach effort. They put people throughout the city to do early canvassing to make sure that they had the most accurate household counts. They had all kinds of activities set up. And really, it was a recognition by Mayor Duggan that the census was critical to Detroit's future in terms of income, in terms of resources, in terms of its standing in the country as it's continued to drop. It's going to be soon drop out of the top 25 cities in the country. All that was done away with once the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And so everything that they set up, you know, there was still obviously media outreach and there were other ways to get at people, but it really was for Detroit and for communities of color, it's that high touch. You have to get out there. You have to be knocking on doors. You have to be meeting people where they are. You have to go to community events. You have to really pull people together because they just, as you asked, I mean, folks are not necessarily seeing the census the way maybe I do or the statisticians or the politicians or anybody else. They don't really necessarily see the importance. They don't see how it affects them. They're not really seeing the federal government as caring one iota about their situation. They don't see the schools necessarily being improved or at least an infusion of money. They don't see money coming into their neighborhoods. So it's that real direct connection between the census and their future and the city's future is kind of a difficult concept. And so it really requires people to get out there, people to hear from people they trust. So hearing information in the churches has always been one of the major ways of reaching out to people. And so churches were closed. So that's the hard part. And so we've seen Detroit just reached 48% response rate as of yesterday. Hmm. We're still below 50%. And you asked, I was looking at some numbers just because that's what I do, right? and so I looked at communities that have the major communities that are below 60% response rate. And they represent about 12 communities and they represent 10% of the state's population, but they represent 51% of the state's African-American population. They represent 16% of the state's Latino population and only 2.3% of the state's white population. Hmm. So we're seeing right off the bat that the low response rates are really affecting communities of color. And if I were to add poverty to that, you'd see the same kind of thing. It's those communities that need the resources that come from census counts. And they are woefully behind in terms of response rates. And just one point is response rates are based on addresses. That's the thing. It's not on people. So in many of these older communities, in many of these minority communities, you have large numbers of vacancies as well. So it's not just people not responding. It's also a large number of vacancies that will not be figured into the response rate until we're able to send enumerators out to follow up. So,
but that might be hard to do this year. I mean, we might not see enumerators really making their way out into the field. Is that true?
Well, the way they've got it right now is that enumerators were supposed to be out there and finished by July 31st. That was the original.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we're talking about the census is April 1st, right? We're supposed to count people April 1st. They've now moved that response follow-up to end in October 31st. So we're going to be having people out there in October knocking on doors of homes and asking people did you live there on April 1st?
Right.
I mean, it's going to be total confusion. And certainly in communities like Detroit and other low-income communities, you have people moving. And now if we have foreclosures and if we have evictions and those kinds of things, that's going to add to the difficulties. So it's the whole delay in the process is going to make it even more confusing. It's going to make it more difficult to count. It's going to make it more difficult to get to that final rate. And it's going to, I believe, certainly add to potential undercounts going forward.
We've talked about this moment creating what could potentially be considered a very lost year for most students that go to the classroom. Do you feel like this could be a lost census in some ways, or do you hold out more hope than that?
Well, I think it's going to be, you know, if Trump is talking about questioning the results of the election, I think we're going to be doing a lot of questioning the results of the census. And the thing is, there's no way that we're going to be able to correct it. The courts have said we can't do statistical adjustment of the census. They will, after the census is over, presumably they will still do what they call, you know, kind of a check. They'll do selected counts, kind of a survey, to get an idea of what potential undercounts there are. But there's no way to adjust that. So I think in many communities, I don't know with the other kinds of procedures that are all delayed, what exactly we're going to be able to finish. I mean, the process is so much delayed, and when they do finally send people out, how is that going to work? So I agree. I think it's going to be a lost census in many ways, but we are going to have to live with it regardless. The numbers will be written in stone come, well, the state is now, state numbers are now not due until April 30th instead of December 31st. And the detailed information for redistricting is now, instead of April 1st, will be out July 31st, 2021. Those are the numbers we'll use. Those are the numbers will be used for redistricting. Those will be the numbers that people will use when they're doing business locations and everything else, and the funding.
It'll still be the official count. Yeah.
I expect a lot of problems, but it is what it is again, and we'll have to live with it.
Kurt Metzger is the founder and director emeritus of Data Driven Detroit. He's also the mayor of the city of Pleasant Ridge. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly my pleasure. Thank you.
As we just heard from Kurt, the area of greatest concern with the census in Michigan is that Black and Latino communities will be undercounted, underrepresented. And being underrepresented in the national data can have large implications for those communities. Here to talk about it is someone who thinks about this a lot in her role with the Hispanic Center of West Michigan, Daniela Rojas Cortez. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Daniela, could you start by telling us a little bit about the community of Wyoming or in general, West Michigan?
Sure. So the Hispanic Center at large really serves Grand Rapids, but of course we do have a lot of clients that live in Wyoming, and there's a variety of people that we see. For the majority, I would say that we see undocumented individuals, but they are also Latinos that are first, second, third generation that live here in West Michigan. Some are U.S. born, some are not. Some are in the process of acquiring their green card, and some continue to kind of fight that battle.
I noticed in the census data from 10 years ago that in Wyoming, the population is about 22-23% Latino. But then, of course, in this course of this conversation, I'm thinking, well, that might be an underrepresentation in and of itself. Is that true to what you observe as the population in that area?
Yes, I would say that it is largely undercounted, and it probably was largely undercounted back in 2010. We know that those groups are growing faster and faster, and we know that it, usually all of West Michigan, about 16%, make up the population, but we got to know that it's probably closer to 20 to 25.
When we talk about West Michigan at large, it's very easy to think, well, of course, there are larger swaths of Latino immigrants who have come to the area as migrant farmers. But what is drawing people to West Michigan in general beyond that?
Yeah, I think the service industry and the farms that we do have in the West Michigan, makes up for a lot of the jobs that Latinos have. There's also factories that employ large numbers of people. But I would say there is a huge population out in like our blueberry farms here on the West Coast of the state.
So the center got a grant to become a census hub. What has that meant for operations there, and how is it going?
So, of course, the pandemic kind of put a halt to our ability to become a hub. The idea behind being a hub was to be able to give people access to the technology so that they could complete the census online. Mm-hmm. So now our efforts have turned to more about education through flyers and word of mouth. So we take full advantage of our food distribution that we are doing because of the pandemic to be able to get this education out, as well as our social media outlets.
And how is it going?
It's going okay. You know, the United Way and the City of Grand Rapids do keep us updated, and we're doing okay in terms of percentages. It's not as good as we would like it to be. There's still a lot of misconception and confusion around the census. And of course, the pandemic sort of put the census even further in a back burner. If it wasn't in people's mind, definitely it's not in their mind right now during the pandemic as they're trying to survive day to day.
Daniela, would you say that the challenges have more to do with access and the ability to communicate with people who should be counted who aren't, or a resistance to being counted in the census?
I think there's a combination. There is, of course, the access to technology is huge. And of course, there's some people that have had to back or limit their data on their cell phones or smartphones due to the pandemic or losing jobs. But we know that language barriers, poverty, the education of perhaps the head of household, and then the immigrant status is really all of those play part into why people are not completing the census.
I think we are living in an era where we can safely say that social media alone has created a vibe of misconception, misinformation, and just general conspiracy theory beyond that.
Yes.
But has there been some of what we've seen coming down from whether or not there would be a question about citizenship on the census, which there isn't? Has some of that has been tangible and reported from Washington affected the interest or desire to participate in the census among the Latino population?
I think it has definitely played a better role, or at least to say that it encouraged people. But again, there's still distrust. You know, you can say that, you know, they're not going to ask you, but they're still asking for your name. They're still asking for your address. They're still asking for very personal information. And I think that another thing that really backs people away from participation is just this aggressive immigration reform that we currently have. So that participation kind of lowers because it's like, well, you say that you care about counting Latinos, you care about the Latinx community being represented, but look at what's also happening with immigration reform.
Do you think that this is something that has an easy solve to you over the near term or long term?
I think as right now we're looking at some of the largest demographic that are young U.S. born Latinos that will be eligible to vote. So I think that there'll be a higher interest for these this new wave of children to participate not only in the census, but to vote. So I think we're going in the right direction, but it's probably going to take a few more decades for the Latino numbers to be accurately accounted for.
This week, the Trump administration also announced that it wants undocumented immigrants to be discounted from congressional representation. That would be completely unprecedented in how congressional numbers are divvied up among states. What would that mean for West Michigan?
We do know that it's super important that that congressional representation is included, especially as we get closer to voting, because we want these numbers to be represented. And a lot of these people will need language assistance. And if you're not accounted for in your county, then they won't know about the assistance that by law is required, depending on those numbers.
So when you're talking to individuals about the importance of filling out a census form, what do you talk to them about the significance of doing so and the importance of it?
We need to rely on especially how it benefits them if they're not documented. A lot of the misconception is, well, you know, if I'm undocumented, how are how is this going to impact me? So we talk about the general things that will impact their children in terms of education, access to food, and then also the longevity of that money that gets distributed. Perhaps you're not in a position to directly benefit from it now, but you could be in 6, 8 years, and that funding is necessary for all of that. So a lot of the questions we do get is, you know, who has access to the information? Who will have access to my personal information? What is it for? And so we try to relay messages about general hospitals, health, and of course, fixing the roads and that kind of thing.
Daniela, what else is on your mind when it comes to the count?
Let's see. I think it's just important that we have these conversations and that families are having this conversation, especially as children are more and more U.S. born, so that people understand that Medicaid and food supplemental nutrition assistance programs and all of those things that really impact the children, that the families really take into account, that they may not benefit, but their children will, so that to make sure that they get accounted.
Daniela Rojas Cortez is with Fund Development and Communications at the Hispanic Center of Western Michigan. Daniela, thank you so much.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll check in with the Michigan History Center and learn about the Colored People's Convention of 1843, held in a church basement in Detroit. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Wepper Davis, in for April Bear. The fight for justice and equal rights started before our nation's inception. In Michigan, less than a decade after becoming a state, the Colored People's Convention was held in the basement of a church in Detroit. Joining us now to explain and compare the grievances of 1843 to those of today is Michigan History Center's curator of exhibits, Jillian Reese. Jillian, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So if I see, and in fact, when I first heard about the state convention of the colored citizens of the state of Michigan, my brain automatically assumed that it was in 1940, but no, it was 100 years before that.
Yes. Yes. This was probably the first mass gathering of Black Michiganders to call for their equal civil rights in our state's history.
Of course, we pretty quickly in our brains associate slavery with the South, but there were slaves living all over the country at various points. How did the bulk of the Black population get to Michigan by 1840s?
Since the first Euro-Americans and Europeans came to Michigan, there were people of African descent with them. Some of them were freedmen, you know, folks that were either released from slavery or had never been enslaved. But then also English and French traders brought enslaved people with them to Michigan. Once the Erie Canal opened, Michigan became much more accessible to the Northeast. But there was also quite a large number of Black Americans who also made this move along the Erie Canal to take advantage of the fact that they could buy cheap land in Michigan.
Talk about this convention specifically. By 1843, how many people had gathered? Where did they gather and under what auspices?
During the 19th century, of course, and until after the Civil War, Black Americans could not vote. And colored conventions were a way for them to demonstrate their political savvy and sophistication. And so the convention wanted to organize and put a line in the sand that Black Americans were not, especially in the North, were not going to allow themselves to be the victims of state violence. The Michigan Convention in 1843 was held only a few years after Michigan became a state. And the convention allows us to have a look into Black life in Michigan that is missing in official state records. And it was chaired by a successful Detroit businessman called William Lambert. And he would become an essential patron of the Underground Railroad network. We don't know exactly how many people were at the convention. What we do know is that three newspapers covered the convention, including the Detroit Free Press. There was a call for participation published in the newspapers announcing that the Black community would be holding this convention. They also then published a record of the convention after.
So what were some of the biggest grievances or planks of the platform that came out of this convention?
One of the things that they wanted to do was to show that they understood the context of American liberty and the values of the founding fathers. And so they spent a lot of time comparing the oppression that Black Michiganders faced to the oppression faced by other groups who fought for liberty and compared themselves to the founding fathers. It was a very specific vision of Black activism focused on being dignified and orderly. So you can see this sort of idea that we are going to be dignified in the face of oppression, kind of as a thread that runs through fights for Black liberation in the United States. They also really focused on two major grievances. The one of taxation without representation. Of course, this is taking the founding fathers' words straight out of their mouths, that they were paying taxes, that they owned businesses, that they were central to the fabric of Michigan, but they did not have the right to vote. They did not have a voice in the political system in Michigan. At this time of statehood, Michigan had some of the least restrictive voting laws in the country, and yet most people in Michigan could not vote. Women, Black folks, and Native Americans could not vote. And so the convention called for the word white to be removed from the definition of electors in Michigan's constitution. The other thing that they were really focused on was inadequate access to education. Again, Michigan was founded as a state who wanted to make sure that every child got education. It's something that has really set us apart throughout our history is the dedication to education here. But because of segregation, Black children weren't allowed to get an equal education. So they really wanted not only the vote, but then an access to equal education for their children.
When you look at the convention from, well, we're nearing 180 years ago, I suppose, what strikes you about how much has changed or how much has stayed the same when we're talking about debates of race today?
So they talked about speaking to their white friends and white people that they came in contact with, that they would challenge them and ask them to stand up for them. They petitioned the legislature, but then they also went to their social networks and really talked to their friends and neighbors about their oppression that they faced. And then the other thing I would say is that a lot of the things that they're talking about, education, political representation, state violence, these are all similar issues that the current protests are focused on. Economic opportunities, you know, having the ability to live without fear that someone is going to come and drag you out of your house at this time and hurt you is, I think, a very similar fear that a lot of Black Americans feel when they are in public in the United States. I think it really speaks to how deeply embedded some of these issues are. The major difference between today and back then, one, is that people can vote, but also this was a meeting in a church basement. And what we've seen is maybe millions of people of all races and ethnicities calling for racial equality in the United States. So, you know, this looking out to your network and pushing your friends and petitioning the legislature does lead to change because, you know, it's not being talked about in hushed basements anymore.
If not very slowly anyway.
Yes, exactly.
Jillian Reese is curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center.
Thanks.
To find out more on the history of colored people's conventions, go to coloredconventions.org. Michigan Radio's podcast Kids These Days' latest episode explores the Orwellian aspect of 21st century technology. What happens when your parents become Big Brother and track your every move?
Hey, I'm Maisie. This is Kids These Days, a podcast by teens about teens. Back when our parents were young, things were a lot different. In terms of grades, they were sent home every 5 weeks or so with a grade report. When they came home from school,
the rule was always when I walked in the door at home, after I got off the bus and walked home, I would pick up the phone and call mom.
This is Craig Levin, a high school teacher who grew up in the 80s.
If I was going to not do something, we would always have to talk about what I would be doing. And, you know, I'm going to John's house after school, or I'm going to go next door. Sometimes I'd leave notes for my parents, like a handwritten note.
You know as well as I do that we're way past sticking notes on the fridge. Because of our phones, our parents can track us anytime they want. And our grades? Apps make them accessible to our parents 24/7. My parents definitely used to use PowerSchool to look at my grades.
Mine too.
This is Kate Weiser. She's a sophomore. With all this brand new technology, you'd think there would be a rule book, some instruction on how often to use the apps, if ever.
But there's not. So parents have to go with their gut. And kids? Well, we have to go with our gut too, and try not to get caught in the process. So I wanted to know, do kids change their behavior because they know they're being watched? Craig Levin's oldest daughter got her phone when she was in eighth grade. Her dad downloaded restrictive apps on the phone, including tracking, website blockers, and screen time. He talked to me about how all this surveillance affects his daughter's choices.
I know things that they're doing because I can see it or I can hear about it, but no, it doesn't prevent my kids from doing anything.
I'm not sure about that. If you know what your kids are doing, doesn't that stop them from doing things you might not approve of? Can't you stop them if you know it's happening?
But I think that we're in the age of more information is better. But I don't know how true that is.
I talked to another person about their experience being surveyed as a teen. We're not using his name because of why he's now tracked. The summer going into his senior year of high school, his parents busted him for smoking weed.
And they were like, oh, like, you're definitely, like, using drugs. And I was like, okay, you got me. Like, and then they, like, were like, okay, you have to have Life 360 on your phone now.
Life 360 is a tracking app that was created for families. It alerts users when people in their family circle enter or leave a saved location, such as school, home, or a friend's house. The app shows the battery percentage on the people's phones, saves their location history, and even offers a premium service, where you can track the speed of your car and get crime reports in your area.
Every time I say I'm going out with friends, they'll, like, check on it routinely just to see, like, where I'm at, I think. Like, there have been times where I've been, like, parked in a parking lot waiting for a friend, or, like, or parked in a parking lot not waiting for a friend, doing something else, and they'll text me.
But the tracking app doesn't stop him from doing what he wants. It makes him sneakier. He used the internet and apps like TikTok to research ways around the location service. A lot of his friends use the excuse, I forgot my phone at home. But he's not forgetful, so he says that excuse could never work.
I wish I could choose to just not have a phone sometimes, because I'm envious of people that back in like the 1960s and 50s where they were like, Mom, I'm going out. And your mom either was like, no, I don't believe you. Or they were like, okay, be safe. Like, parents will be like, how am I going to know where you are if you don't have your phone with Life 360 on it? Where it's like, imagine you're like, your parental ancestors had to like just trust your kids. That's crazy. Like, there's like this continued spiral of like relying on technology that's just going to continue and continue.
My name is Caroline. I'm a sophomore at Community High.
Caroline's parents started monitoring her in middle school. They used Find My to track her location and PowerSchool to check her grades. Her parents have PowerSchool set up so they get notifications whenever assignments are graded. Caroline says she gets text messages and calls from her dad during school if anything is marked missing or if she gets a low grade. The constant monitoring created a rift between her and her parents.
I really chose not to spend, like, any time at home. Like, I spent most of my time at, like, after-school clubs or hanging out with friends or whatever. And I really just, like, whenever I was kind of around my family, I wasn't, like, enjoying it because I didn't feel like they trusted me.
It took a long time for Caroline and her parents to rebuild that trust. Even by taking baby steps, they experienced many setbacks, but in the end, it was for the best. It took a lot of openness and honesty from Caroline.
Definitely, there were times that like I would end up like crying and like telling my parents that I didn't feel like they trusted me at all.
Caroline described many nights where they would sit down and talk through why they were monitoring her so heavily. And she would explain to them why it was so hard for her. Eventually, she realized if she just stuck to their rules, it would work in her favor too.
They would tell me to be home at 10, I'd be home by like 10, and then maybe then they would push the curfew to like 10:30 the next night or whatever. Just knowing that like I wasn't like completely rebelling and I was listening to them as they were trying to listen to me too.
I'm Anya, I'm 18, and my parents have been tracking my location and monitoring me since I got my phone, sixth grade.
Anya's parents have eased up on her as she's gotten older, but they used to be constantly checking up on her.
Every time I would come and leave the house, they'd get a notification, and every time I'd come and leave school, they would get a notification. So, like, their phones were constantly buzzing as I would, like, go anywhere.
Anya's parents installed Life 360 on her phone when she got it when she was 11. At first, they used the app to make sure she was safe. But after a while, things changed. They started watching her location to see if she was sneaking out.
My friend texted me in the middle of the night. It wasn't even the middle of the night. It was, like, 11 p.m. And she wanted to go to Insomnia Cookies.
Anya felt she had two options. Wake her parents up to ask if she could go, or just go without telling them.
And in my 16-year-old brain, I thought it sounded like a better idea to go and not tell them. So it was raining that night. The rain was coming down pretty hard, and I went out onto my little balcony thing that's connected to my room.
She climbed off the balcony and slipped. She grabbed the gutter to try and stop her fall and pulled half of it off with her and landed in the mud below.
And so I was like, really shaken up, and I just like ran to my car and got in my car and drove to my friend's house.
Right as she pulled into her friend's driveway, she got a text from her father. It demanded that she come home and that he knew where she was.
So I turned around and I drove home, sobbing. And I remember coming back in the house, just like crying and soaking wet, and my parents just being like, why would you do that? Like, we heard your car pull away one, and then we heard like a car outside, and then we looked at your location and easily could just saw that you weren't home. So why did you think you could get away with that?
After being tracked for 7 years, Anya was hoping for a reprieve when she went to college. When she asked her parents if they would turn it off when she was 18, they answered with a prompt no.
So what was that conversation like when you turned 18, like asking them to turn it off and then having them say no?
It wasn't that much of a conversation, if I'm being honest. It was more like, so are you still going to track me when I turn 18? Yes. And that was just the end of the conversation. I mean, I would definitely rather them not track me, but I'm not that upset about it because I kind of have become accustomed to it because it's just been like a fact of my life is that my parents know where I am. No matter what I'm doing, my parents can see my location. And that's just like become so normalized to me that I almost can't imagine a world that my parents don't know where I am at any given moment.
I should mention here that I reached out to all of my sources' parents for interviews, but none of them wanted to be interviewed or go on tape. But since Anya has been tracked since she got a phone, like a lot of us, she wanted to share some advice, both for parents and kids.
I understand tracking your kids, but I think once you start checking it, out of distrust is when it becomes an issue. Sorry, Mom and Dad, if you're listening, but we leave our phones places if we're going somewhere. And if you think about it, that's kind of dangerous because then what if something happens and you don't have a phone? So I think my message to parents is just be conscious of how often you are checking in on your kids and how you're making them feel by it. And try to avoid the reason for location tracking being mistrust, because trust, if your kids feel trusted, then they will be more honest and in the end, I think, more safe. And I guess my message to kids is I know it sucks,
but it won't be forever.
Support for kids these days comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund and the Children's Foundation. And that's going to do it for Stateside today. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for joining us. See you tomorrow.